and it's 6 past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, lurking conservatives. How are you? It's Wednesday morning. It's the day after the faux Christian, AWOL, ex-blow monkey puppet of the Cheney regime's neocon death cult, again, tried to present the country with a load of BS to justify his presence and the military's presence in Iraq. 55 seconds, Mark Riley, 55 seconds in and two sentences into the speech proper, the semantic engine of 9/11 was started last night at Fort Bragg by President Bush. I don't like when the press calls it a card, Riley. They're using the 9/11 card. This is the lives of 3,000 people that this guy continues to exploit for political reasons.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I told you it was going to happen.
You did.
And the reason for that, Mark Maron, is because the speech last night was tactical, not substantive. And we'll get in. We got a long time to talk about it today, and we'll get into some of the things he could have said of substance that would have helped American troops. But we'll get into that later.
But it was shameless. It was shameless. The guy is shameless, and he had his jaw going because he was on that confidence cocktail concocted by him, by the pharmaceutical companies, which are some of his biggest lobbyists. I believe that. I believe the guy's on some sort of strange combination of Wellbutrin, Ritalin, I don't know what, but he had the blow jaw going again.
Well, you know, I didn't watch the speech last night. I actually turned over in bed and listened to it without looking at his
face.
Well,
good for you. That means you didn't have that weird sort of, you know, at least the visionary induced hate buzz
I
get.
Because I would have turned it off if I had watched it.
It's just fascinating to me that this guy has the nads to continue to exploit this national tragedy and politicize it without really getting to the truth of what's going on and being honest with the American people in a way that would treat them like adults. You know, he's throwing words like totalitarianism out there. He's throwing, how many times? You know how many times he said 9/11? Do you know how many references?
I think it was either 5 or 6 references.
Well, you know, if we could, Chris, why don't we lay that down?
The war reached our shores on September the 11th, 2001. The only way our enemies can succeed is if we forget the lessons of September the 11th. After September the 11th, I made a commitment to the American people. After September the 11th, 2001, I told the American people that the road ahead would be difficult. They are trying to shake our will in Iraq, just as they tried to shake our will on September the 11th, 2001.
So that's 5, Riley. That's 5.
5. 9/11 remix.
It was good. And the interesting thing is this administration is trying to take $125 million away from New York City's workers' comp in order to, because they didn't spend it this year and the budget wants it back because we here in New York, the government here in New York was waiting because who the hell knows what could have happened to those people that spent so many hours working to uncover what was going on down there and all the emergency workers. And they also were trying to take back money that was allotted for the victims of 9/11. And for him to use it and continue to use it without addressing some of these realities is really heinous to me.
Well, you know, Mark, it dawned on me after listening to the speech last night that the American, at least as far as the Bush administration is concerned, the American people have set the bar so low in terms of what they expect from the President of the United States. This is a man who was attempting to shore up both congressional and popular support without having to present strategic initiative the first. He didn't say, we have a bold new plan for accelerating the training of Iraqi troops. He didn't say, we have some new plan in terms of how we're going to shore up the coalition presence there so that we can start withdrawing troops. He didn't present anything of substance whatsoever. What he did was essentially recycle.
Yeah, and recycle, but I thought what he did do, Riley, was present us with an enemy that he thinks is going to be there for the rest of time. I think that in the neocons in their spin and in their propaganda have sort of efficiently, at least on a metaphorical level, replaced Cold War Russia and Cold War Soviet bloc countries by saying when he read that list of the places where there was terrorist activity, mm-hmm. He went through like 6 or 7 countries. And all I heard, he was trying to use that as an example – realize we still got problems. I heard that that's where the future of wars are going to be. I heard that we're in a global conflict now that is escalating because of this administration. We have proof that terrorism around the world has escalated since George Bush has been in office. So what I heard was a guy saying, look, not only are we going to be in Iraq indefinitely, but this is the way it's going to be for the rest of time. We're going to use this to police this planet and continue to encourage military profiteering and continue to encourage a state of fear in this country and throughout the world. We created the Iraq that exists today. When he says that we freed it from tyranny into chaos. There was tyranny, but there wasn't terrorism. When he says that these people are coming from other countries to fight us, these outside terrorists, we are training terrorists for the new generation, not unlike the Russians did when the Afghani Arabs, were fighting against the Russians at our behest. These guys are going to disperse, and what I think he presented last night was the new plan for the new century to have an enemy that will last forever.
Well, yeah, and he is kind of using a political calculus here that has served others in the past, and that is the idea that, linking all this together, presenting what was in essence Paul Wolfowitz and Richard Perle's vision from 1995 about how the Middle East is going to look. By presenting that, he is trying to get the American people off the idea that this is going to, that there's going to be some any short-term gain here, that there's going to be anything that will allow America to start gradually disengaging. You're right. This is war without end.
It's war without end, and it's also starting to characterize. He did it last year. He did it again today. He's starting to characterize what is essentially, a jihadist war. There's a religious ideology behind much of the momentum in terms of terrorism, but there's also the Baathists in Iraq and disenfranchised Iraqis that are starting to fight. But on a global level, by using the word, let's listen to this clip, Caleb, could we?
The terrorists who attack us and the terrorists we face, murder in the name of a totalitarian ideology that hates freedom, rejects tolerance, and despises all dissent. Their aim is to remake the Middle East in their own grim image of tyranny and oppression, by toppling governments, by driving us out of the region, and by exporting terror.
See, he's congealing this enemy under this idea of totalitarianism, which was not a word used a lot, except in relation to Soviet Russia. Mm-hmm. So what we're doing is we're getting this metaphor that he's starting to work in setting up a new Cold War dynamic with a sort of free-floating enemy that could show up anywhere for a lot of different reasons, primarily, Muslim, jihadism. But by using the word totalitarianism, I think he's setting up a language to what we said before, to engage in a standoff that could last indefinitely.
Well, yeah, and remember that along with totalitarianism, he also used the word freedom 21 times in this situation. He never used the words mission accomplished, but he used the word mission 11 times. Of course, he's speaking before a military audience at Fort Bragg who understand very clearly what the term mission is all about. And later on this morning, we'll talk about some of his flag-waving 4th of July, let's help military families rhetoric, which is as empty as the rest of his speech.
We've talked to so many people, Riley, who have been there. We talked to Mick Ware. We talked to Rod Nordland. We talked to Borzu Daragahi, all journalists that have spent time in Iraq indefinitely. And they talk about progress, but they talk about incremental progress. And when George Bush says, in terms of they made schools, roads, infrastructures, they're building, we know that billions of this dollars that have gone into rebuilding is missing. We know billions have gone out there in duffel bags. It wasn't allocated properly. And I'm starting to think that they must be talking about this model neighborhood, like 5 square blocks somewhere tucked away in the heart of the green zone that they give walking tours to for foreign dignitaries in the press. But, the progress, I still say, seems limited to me in relation to the horrendous violence that goes there on there on a day-to-day basis.
Well, I mean, Bush gives this speech, and earlier in the same day in Iraq, the oldest member of the National Assembly is blown up by a suicide bomber.
Mm-hmm.
There is just no end to the level of violence that America has engendered in Iraq. That's not to say Saddam Hussein was a great guy. That's not to say his rule should have stood necessarily. But the question is whether or not America should have acted militarily to end his rule. And that's the thing that Bush is trying to push to the side for, you know, in service of this grand vision of the Middle East, where he invokes the Palestinians, he invokes the Egyptians and the Lebanese and everybody else in the region to try and paint this picture, which is terminally flawed.
Yeah, I think his vision is chaos. I think this is, on some level, exactly what they wanted. They gave Saddam the weapons that he fought us with. We're giving Pakistan weapons. I think chaos, guaranteeing chaos and problems in the future, is exactly what a president who panders to military profiteering does. We're going to come back and compare the language of the speech from last year that he gave almost exactly a year to the day of last night, and we'll see how propaganda works. I hope you're having an okay morning. It's 16 past the hour. You're listening to Morning's Edition with Mark and Mark. It's Air America Radio, so more about Bush's speech coming up next.
MorningsEdition.com. Our guests, our comedy, your blog. MorningsEdition.com. Air America Radio.
243-1483. That's 1-800-243-1483. Call Stop Sign right now. 1-800-243-1483.
21 past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
It's Morning's Edition on Air America Radio. We're going to start comparing now. We're going to compare last year's state of, it's not even a State of the Union address. It's the year anniversary. Well, last year was actually the turnover, the two-day turnover of the power to the Iraqis prematurely because his polls were plummeting.
Yeah.
This year, on the year anniversary, his polls also plummeting, trying to sort of shore up his support and whatnot. If you've got comments festering, you can call us. I know it's early, but 866-303-2270 if you want. I just wanted to let you know that that's available to you if you want to share some comments. So now let's just take sound from last year. This is last year at the Army War College. This is the George W. Bush, the faux Christian AWOL Explo Monkey puppet of the Cheney regime's neocon death cult, talking to the Army War College. Chris,
we're making progress. If there still is much work to do.
All right. Now this is last night at Fort Bragg.
We've made progress, but we have a lot more work to do.
He kind of stumbled.
On what? He forgot his lines?
No, I think that he has those moments where it's like literally, he's like, "You're lying," and he's like, "Shut up." You know, that's what happens in that moment where he's like, when he stumbles, it's like, you know, how do you live with yourself saying that? Shut up. And then he goes on.
Looking at him this morning, we looked at the speech. It was the first time seeing it early this morning. And you see that shiftiness in his eyes that are kind of sort of like he's waiting for somebody in the audience to kind of call him on what he's saying. And he wants to kind of get it over with as soon as he possibly can.
This is last year from the Army War College speech talking about troop levels.
General Abizaid and other commanders in Iraq are constantly assessing the level of troops they need to fulfill the mission. If they need more troops, I will send them.
Mm-hmm. And this is last night at the Fort Bragg speech.
Some Americans ask me if completing the mission is so important, why don't you send more troops? If our commanders on the ground say we need more troops, I will send them.
Well, according to Newsweek, Bush's speech last night was modeled after his Army War College speech last May, which received a favorable response. So he lifted literally parts of it. But we know, Riley, as I think you were about to address before I interrupted you there, that, you know, when a commander on the ground says we need more troops, I'll give them to him, that commander would become a past commander very quickly. You should ask, Commander Shinseki about the 300,000. That, you know, he may pay lip service to this, but there's a couple of reasons that it won't happen because it's policy. And because I don't know how many troops we really have left.
Well, you know, that would have at least been honest of George W. Bush to say, look, if our commanders on the ground say we need them, I can't send them anyway because we don't have them. At least then I'd say he was being honest with people. But he's not. He knows good and well that there's a price to be paid, as you very correctly pointed out with General Shinseki, for talking about needing more troops. So nobody talks about it anymore. So now he's saying the commanders on the ground say we don't need them. It is nonsense. He said we had 165,000 Iraqi troops that are trained, and that they're more growing, more people are going to these different recruiting stations to become members of the Iraqi security force. When you have an unemployment rate that ranges between 27% and 40%, yeah, people will take that kind of very dangerous job because the insurgency has targeted these very Iraqi security forces. But out of that 165,000, only about 3,000 can act on their own.
Yeah, so that's certainly not enough. And in terms of talking about what Al-Qaeda's presence there is and what terrorism really means, there's a couple of pieces here from the CIA's National Intelligence Council from 2004. Quote, the Al-Qaeda membership that was distinguished by having trained in Afghanistan will gradually dissipate to be replaced in part by the dispersion of the experienced survivors of the conflict in Iraq. Iraq and other possible conflicts in the future could provide recruitment, training grounds, technical skills, and language proficiency for a new class of terrorists who are professionalized and for whom political violence becomes an end in itself, end quote. Now, Bush says that this is, you know, that the front of the war on terrorism is in Iraq. That's because he created that. We set that up. It was tyranny before. Now it's chaos, and it's a chaos that is a breeding ground for terrorism. You have to understand. Now, first of all, Osama bin Laden, still at large. The people that that ran those planes in the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, and they were Saudis, and they were trained, many of them, and Osama primarily, was trained in Afghanistan fighting the Russians. And that was almost primitive compared to what they're training, fighting against us in Iraq. We are creating a new generation of terrorists that will guarantee perpetual war for an administration and an ideology that panders to war profiteering and exploitation of fear on a global level to serve its own ends. That's what's happening here. Some of this is exactly what they want to happen, I think, Mark Riley.
Well, it is exactly what they want to have happen. And George W. Bush will swear up and down that he does not look at public polling and that sort of thing, but his advisors have told him that loss of public support for war, which we're seeing in every published poll over the last month, Mark, every single poll is saying that the public is no longer down with the war in Iraq. And that could doom not just George W. Bush's presidency, but the Republican Congress when they come up for re-election next year.
Right.
And that's what he's afraid of. This is all political calculus. This is all tactics. And to me, it is a shame that the American troops have to sit there and or stand there, as it turns out, and listen to this man wrap himself in them for a political purpose.
We are fighting a war against an enemy that we created in a lot of ways and that we plan to create. And it's like, and I don't want to use myself in the collective we. I feel bad for the troops that have to deal with a level of untruth that comes out of this administration. We're going to come back and lighten it up a little bit.
Yeah.
Supreme Court Justice David Souter's house might be taken because of a ruling that he helped make.
Yeah, right.
That's coming up next. You're listening to Morning Sedition with Mark and Mark at 27 past the hour on Air America Radio.
Let the man go through. Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
D-D-D-D. Rumsfeld.
The Mike Malloy Show on Air America Radio.
Thirty-four past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
It's Morning Sedition. You're listening to Air America Radio. Hope you're having as good a morning as possible. I watched the repeat or the TiVo'd Bush speech. I watched half of it last night. I watched the other half this morning. Then I watched all of it again just to get my hate buzz going. 55 seconds in, my friends, and two sentences into the speech proper, the semantic engine of 9/11 was started. Kalo, can we play the montage?
The war reached our shores on September the 11th, 2001. The only way our enemies can succeed is if we forget the lessons of September the 11th. After September the 11th, I made a commitment to the American people. After September the 11th, 2001, I told the American people that the road ahead would be difficult. They are trying to shake our will in Iraq, just as they tried to shake our will on September the 11th, 2001.
Five references to September 11th. References to an exit strategy, Riley? Zero.
No references to an exit strategy.
References to mission accomplished? Zero.
Zero. But see, what he's going to do today, he's not even going to do it. What his people will do today is say that what we heard just now didn't actually happen.
Mm.
What they're going to say, well, he didn't really link September 11th with Iraq.
No, it wasn't a linking. It was exploiting the deaths of 3,000 people to mobilize the type of fear necessary that he thinks will get his poll numbers up. To refer to this, the terrorist now is a totalitarian organization being driven by totalitarian means. He's trying to set the stage to create an enemy that is capable of staying in the imagination for eternity. He's trying to set up the stage for an eternal conflict so people with ideologies like his can pander to war profiteering for the rest of time. He said that Iraq went from tyranny under Saddam Hussein to whatever it is now, which is chaos, which is a terrorist breeding ground, breeding the next generation of terrorists, so these guys can continue fighting forever all around the planet. We're going to get more into that in a second, but right now, sometimes when you read the headlines, it can be tough to figure out just what's exactly is happening. Thank God we got the machine, so let's bring it out, the iNews 5000 Wi-Fi headline translator. From CNN, poll, U.S. confidence in Iraq war slides. Poll, U.S. confidence in Iraq war slides. Translation, as a distraction, Bush plans to invade U.S. From Fox News, Canadian lawmakers pass bill legalizing gay marriage. Canadian lawmakers pass bill legalizing gay marriage. Translation, Canadians say, let the gays get married, eh? From the Associated Press, Clinton rides on Elder Bush's boat. Clinton rides on Elder Bush's boat. Translation, two former presidents share boat while current one goes up creek without a paddle. Okay. Those are entertaining.
Yeah.
Supreme Court Justice David Souter might lose his land and house because of a decision he voted for in the aftermath of a Supreme Court decision that ruled 5-4 that the federal law does not prevent local governments from using eminent domain to take property from one private owner and giving it to another, provide the action be for the public good, primarily on an economic level. A California developer has just filed papers that he hopes will permit him to take Supreme Court Justice David Souter's home in Ware, New Hampshire, and build a hotel on the property.
Eminent domain.
He said the property would be serve the public interest more. Obviously, this is an action of protest for the decision, which I think is genius. The guy says he's already got investors up to $50,000, and he guess what he wants to call the hotel? The Liberty Hotel.
Lost Liberty Hotel.
Yeah, there'll be a little plaque there that says this is on the site of Justice Chief Justice David Souter's former residence.
Yeah, tours, $3.
Well, on a sort of a negative note, I believe, is that the eminent domain statute, is that a statute or a rule or a law?
A ruling
has already been taken into action in Freeport, Texas, where officials there have started to push a couple of fish. They're not pushing them out, but there's a couple of fish businesses, that one of which has been there since the 40s, that brings in like $40 million a year, that they're going to allow to stay on the property, but they're trying to get the property so they can build an $8 million private marina there, which will be the part of an urban renewal to create a real estate venture and mall, I'm sure, mm-hmm. to pander and cater to the wealthy to redevelop the area. But what I don't understand, Riley, is if you've got a fish business down there making $40 million a year,
mm-hmm.
how do they say that what they plan is going to be more in the public interest economically?
Well, because they say they expect to attract $60 million.
Okay,
that's how they do it. Well, yeah, essentially, and this is the danger in the Supreme Court's ruling,
mm-hmm.
that someone can say, well, we project that this particular project will make X number of dollars. Now, never mind whether it actually does or not. Never mind whether there's a downturn in the economy that has that marina vacant for the next 20 years.
Right.
The bottom line is, if you predict it and if you can grease the right palms under certain circumstances, because this is something that empowers municipalities. It's not just the state, not just the federal government. This will allow individual towns and cities, individual local governments. Now,
right.
I'm not going to say that all local governments are inherently corrupt. But I live in New Jersey, right?
Well, that's the thing. So this means that, you know, lobbying on the behalf of real estate speculators within the local government could really sway the local government to make these decisions that could put people out of their homes, or could people put lucrative businesses that have been around for generations out of business, force them to move just in the name of some speculator's idea. And God knows that real estate speculators, you know, sometimes that doesn't work out.
No, it doesn't work out. And the other thing is that this empowers these local communities to loosely interpret what the public good is. They don't have to hold a referendum on what is the public good. These people, whether it's town councils, city councils, or whatever, they will decide what the public good is. And if they think your house would be a proper place to demolish because whatever replaces it would be in the public good, then you don't matter anymore as far as people are concerned.
That's unbelievable to me that they can just do that. They can just make this decision that, you know, that could change, that could put people out on the street just at the behest of a real estate speculator who's in cahoots with a local member of the government?
In theory, absolutely. Look, I was my family was a victim of eminent domain in the late 50s, early 60s.
No kidding.
Yeah, when they built an interstate that actually took some land that my family owned in Connecticut. And, you know, that was the first time I heard the term eminent domain. And my father and mother explained it. They said they could take your land if they're going to build an interstate. They will compensate you. Now, they can't just take it and not give you anything for it, but they decide how much the land is worth.
Right. If you decide you want to try and get that offer up, they're going to be like, this isn't an offer. This is a settlement.
This is a settlement.
This is what you get.
And it can really create some very bizarre circumstances. I saw a situation once in Camden, New Jersey, where they built an expressway around a row of tenements so that people and the owner of the tenements would not sell. So it turned out when you walked out of the tenement, you were walking right into the left lane of the highway.
This seems to me to directly sort of pander to the type of thinking of privatizers, that the type of free market thinking that is sympathetic to privatization, to corporate interests over individual interests.
Well, yeah, when it comes to taking people's houses, yeah.
It's unbelievable to me, and I don't understand where the Supreme Court gets off on making decisions like that seem to be so against the people. Obviously, you know, it was a close vote. It was only one.
It was 5-4, sure.
All right. Well, let's get into this a little bit. The Gold Star Mothers, who are a group of mothers who have lost children fighting the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, voted, you know, all wars, I guess, because they've been around since 1929.
Yeah.
Apparently, the charter of the group prevented foreign citizens from joining. But earlier this year, there was a problem. There was an issue. They took some heat. I don't want to say they took some fire. over a Filipino mother whose son was killed in Afghanistan. So they had a vote.
Yeah, they had a vote, and they decided to allow non-citizens to become Gold Star mothers. And, of course, they came under great criticism. By me.
Yeah. It's a former
damn
dog
straight
of the week.
Yeah.
Getting straight here.
Well, yeah, and I salute him, both figuratively and literally. I mean, look, they made a mistake, okay? You can't parse someone's pain, parse someone's contribution based on whether or not they were born in this country. That's ridiculous.
They made a mistake by the board, the 12-member board, unanimously deciding to maintain the charter a year ago and not allow foreign people in, and now they've corrected that mistake. I mean,
yep.
The mistake, that mistake's only a year old. I mean, you know, 1929, that's a long time, but I get the impression that only came up for vote this once last year.
Well, this latest vote took place at their annual convention in Dallas,
right.
And there have been over 140 military service members who were not U.S. citizens who died fighting in both Iraq and Afghanistan.
That's good for them for making it right.
Yeah,
know, it's nice to know that that occurs sometimes.
Well, you know, sometimes our big mouths can. We weren't the only ones. I mean, you know, to their credit, some of the veterans groups in Westchester County, New York, where Ms. Lagerman lives, really rallied to her side on this, and it's good to see the change can happen.
It is great. So look, you know, we got Russ Feingold, senator from Wisconsin, who has become a frequent guest on our show.
Yes,
is going to in just a few minutes. Is going to come on our show and talk about his reaction to George Bush's speech last night at Fort Bragg, where he basically said there is no timetable for us getting out, that we are going to be fighting the enemy that we're generating simultaneously, probably till the end of time, and that's just the way it's going to be. We'll be talking about that a lot throughout the show. We're also going to talk about some other things. things, some other stories out there in the world, and we've got the Cliff Notes coming up in just a second, so stay with us. Hope you're having a decent morning. It is Wednesday, isn't it, Riley?
It is Wednesday.
It's 45 past the hour. It's Morning's Edition with Mark and Mark. You're listening to Air America Radio. Y'all ready for
this? Hi, this is Charles Barkley, and you're listening to Mark Maron and Mark Riley. Anything less would be uncivilized. It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
And so call us right now. 800-430-9571. 800-430-9571.
Past the hour, it's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
It's Wednesday morning. You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. Hope things are okay with you. If you're just tuning in, here are a few highlights of what we talked about on the program. It's time for today's Morning Sedition Cliff Notes. A Russian ex-prisoner at Guantanamo Bay says Korans were regularly flushed down the toilet. An administration official rejected Vakatov's assertions in the strongest possible terms, then took a transcript of the accusations and wiped his ass with it.
No.
One of the Gitmo prison officers says, we didn't just take the Koran and urinate on it. We used one to beat a prisoner with because we couldn't find a phone book. Ronald Reagan was voted the greatest American in an AOL Discovery Channel poll. Experts caution that because the poll was organized by AOL, the results reflect the opinions of people who don't realize they can get better internet service at half what they're paying. It's believed that hardline Republicans started the rumor that Abraham Lincoln might have been gay to siphon off the conservative vote and force him into second place. You know what? That's actually, a lot of people believe that Abraham Lincoln was indeed gay, actually.
Uh-oh.
Trent Lott eyes a, well, Larry Kramer specifically, who I talked to.
And right.
That was a big sidebar of an interview I did with him that we didn't make it to air. But Trent Lott eyes a comeback after praising the Republican Party's most visible racist, Strom Thurmond. Lott took steps after the incident to prove his racial sensitivity, hiring black staffers and consulting with African-American leaders and doing pro bono legal work for Snoop Dogg and 50 Cent. Today's phrase, just drop it in the conversation. Get ready for a fake terror alert any day now. You know how it works. The lower the polls, the higher the paranoia rate. Wake up, sheeple. If Bush's polls get any lower, the gloves are off. Run into the airport men's room and shave that beard. You could be spending this Christmas at Gitmo. Wow, it's a mouthful. There are your Morning Sedition Cliff Notes for today.
Yeah, yeah.
So let's get into that. Trent Lott is gunning for his old, not his old job back, but the job as majority whip. Is that what he's doing? How's he going to handle that, Riley? How's he? Apparently, this guy is a pretty crafty politician.
Well, look, as long as he's in the Senate, Trent Lott can resurrect himself. He was, one of the most powerful people in Congress. He fell from grace, as you just pointed out, because of his laudatory words about Strom Thurmond. I don't know how in the world he managed to pull that one off.
So basically what happened is the Republican says, oh, now everyone knows about the sort of current of racism that runs through our party. Hey, Trent, could you just take a break, give it a rest? Push yourself aside for a little while.
For a little while, but he's been all along doing a little bit of this and a little bit of that because, you know, the Senate is a relatively collegial body.
Mm-hmm.
So what he's been doing is kind of mending fences and trying to build bridges. And, you know, there are some Republicans that worry about whether or not the person that was the consensus whip in the future, Rick Santorum, people are concerned about whether or not he's going to actually hold on to his seat. He's a Republican in a blue state in Pennsylvania, and I think that Lott is figuring, well, you know, if Santorum somehow goes down, then maybe he'll be able to make his comeback.
Yeah. So Santorum's up against a fairly strong Democratic contender, right? From what I remember we talking about it
yeah.
once before. I do know that he was taking some flack in the polls and that, it, as you said, it is a Democratic state. And, you know, I wouldn't mind seeing Rick Santorum go down.
Well, you know, the interesting thing about Trent Lott, and he'll be the first one to tell you this, mm. He has never lost a leadership election in the United States Senate, never.
Mm-hmm.
And what that means is that people, you know, because of the way political calculus works inside the Beltway, folks are very, very hesitant to bet against him. And remember that Trent Lott is one of these people who brings home, quote, the bacon, unquote, for his state. You know, they build C-130s in Mississippi. They do all kinds of military stuff in Mississippi. Why? Because Mississippi has Trent Lott. And from that power base, he is looking now to go back where he used to be.
It's interesting because later in the show we're going to be dealing pretty specifically about institutional racism and racism in general, specifically focusing on Philadelphia, Mississippi.
On Mississippi, yeah, which is where Edgar Ray Killen went down.
Gary Young from the Guardian newspaper of London, who traveled to Philadelphia, Mississippi to gauge the state of race relations in the South, is going to be with us a little later, and we're also going to get into institutionalized racism in the field of psychiatry in just a little while, because this is interesting stuff, and Trent Lott is not the tip of the iceberg in some respect, because he is a very out racist.
Well, you know, Trent Lott would dispute you on that. He'd say, no, I'm not a racist. You know, the blacks in Mississippi, they get to work at the plants
get to is the important word
yeah,
there.
Yeah, get to. Are allowed to.
Exactly.
It's a pretty low wage, too, but we'll get into that.
So how does this happen? Look, I'll tell you how this happens. Ronald Reagan is voted the greatest American on an AOL Discovery Channel poll. I'll tell you how something like this happens. It happens because conservatives will mobilize for anything to get their point of conservatism across. And I'm willing to believe that there was some grassroots networking going on here to get people to vote for Ron Reagan for number one, Ronald Reagan. Number two, Abraham Lincoln. Number three, Martin Luther King. Number four, George Washington. Number five, Benjamin Franklin. Number six, George W. Bush. And then onward. And down, yes.
Whoa. Number six was who?
Sure, George W. Bush. But number 13 was Walt Disney. So, I mean, Oprah made number nine. I mean, this is just a stupid thing. But my point is that people who believe in something will get behind something and tell their friends to get behind it. And this is the way Republicans do things on a grassroots level. And I suspect some rallying here of the troops. And the reason I'm going to tell you this, now we're going to talk more about Bush's speech last night with Senator Russell Feingold from Wisconsin in just a few minutes. But the reason I'm talking about mobilization is I want you to podcast Morning's Edition.
Yeah.
Now, personally, I don't have an iPod. I'm willing to have one if Apple would just send me one, all right? But but podcast Morning's Edition, because we are currently ranked number 54. See, I got an agenda here. We are currently ranked number 54 on iTunes. Kayla found this out. Kayla the Costco Ho and Pod Ho found this out.
Pod Ho?
He's a Pod Ho.
Ooh.
He's a hoe to his pod.
Uh-oh.
Am I right, Kayla?
It's true.
Okay. So you found out that we're number 54 on iTunes, and we'd like to get into the top 10. If that's too much to ask, then don't podcast us. But we'd like you to go podcast us, because if we get into the top 10, then people know about Morning Sedition, which is important.
Yes.
Am I doing this right?
Yeah. The iTunes Hot 100.
So you can automatically get the podcast every day, take Morning Sedition with you all day long. And this helps a lot of people, because in a lot of markets, Riley, we were pushed out mercilessly.
Mercilessly
pushed out by local morning shows at the behest of Clear Channel, who is one of our, I guess, are they our proprietor in some markets?
Our partners.
Okay, partners, fine. but in some places, people miss a half hour, they miss an hour of the show, they miss the show altogether where they once had it, like San Francisco. So podcast us, and let's get up into the top 10.
Go to iTunes.
Of most frequently podcasted thingamajigs.
All right. Senator Russ Feingold up next here on Air America Radio.
It's 6 past the hour. You're listening to Morning's Edition. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hi.
It's Air America Radio. It's Wednesday. I hope you're having a decent morning. Hope you got your coffee going, whatever you do to make you feel okay at the beginning of your day. On the phone, very excited. Senator Russ Feingold introduced a resolution in the Senate earlier this month calling on the White House to create a timetable for both achieving goals in Iraq and for the withdrawal of U.S. troops. Now we'll find out if you like what he heard from the president last night, whose speech seemed to focus around not withdrawing the troops and not providing an exit strategy. Senator Russ Feingold joins us on the phone from Washington, D.C. Good morning, Senator. We're going to make you an honorary co-host.
Well, good morning, and I appreciate all these opportunities. This Iraq situation and the failure to focus on the fight against terrorism in the proper way is so disappointing that I really do want to have more and more people speak out against this administration's policy.
It seems like there was a point, if we could hear it right now, in his presentation, if you just listen with us for a second, Senator.
Sure.
And we fight today because terrorists want to attack our country and kill our citizens. And Iraq is where they're making their stand. So we'll fight them there. We'll fight them across the world. And we will stay in the fight until the fight is won.
Now, what's interesting about that, aside from it sort of committing to an eternal and perpetual war that that has not no significant definition, is that that audience response apparently was prompted by a White House advance team member. And it seems to go directly against and in support of everything that you are standing for right now.
Well, this whole thing, and the president made it very clear last night he wasn't going to tell us anything serious about what we're going to do in Iraq,
mm-hmm.
or we're going to ever get out of there. This is all based on a huge fabrication. You can call it the big fabrication.
Okay.
Conning the American people into believing somehow that Iraq and Saddam Hussein were involved in 9/11. And nobody believes that anymore. And so he uses all the emotion and all the rhetoric that relates to what happened in 9/11 to support an intervention in Iraq that everybody is shocked was based on such bizarre justifications that haven't held up. So this is all he's apparently got left. He won't talk seriously about a time frame for accomplishing the goals he talked about. He won't give us any kind of vision of when the American people can expect the men and women who are fighting so bravely can come home. He gave us nothing other than the same slogans and cliches. And I was watching some of the coverage on TV. Even some of the soldiers and military leaders at Fort Bragg said, you know, it was a great speech, but we are concerned about an indefinite commitment there. So I'm not even sure the audience there was buying these cliches that have been offered for years.
And isn't it safe to say, Senator Feingold, that at this point, the presence of the Americans and what's going on, the chaos that's going on in Iraq, from all from very valid sources, that we are generating a new breed of terrorists there, and that because of that, that simultaneously generating terrorism and fighting at the same time is sort of guaranteeing this eternal struggle?
Well, I think that's exactly what's happening. When the president says we have to remember the lessons of 9/11, I don't think he has any understanding of the lessons of 9/11. What 9/11 is about is what happened in Afghanistan, where a bunch of terrorists were trained because they had a target to practice against, and that was the Soviet Union. And the Soviet Union came basically fell apart in large part because of the enormous failure in Afghanistan. We are setting ourselves up for the exact same situation. We are the drawing card. We are the fuel for terrorists to come into that region, as well as the recruiting of Iraqi terrorists now. And that's exactly how they are fueling this insurgency, because we are the great target. We are in this place. Somehow the president thinks it's beneficial to us to make, or he thinks all the terrorists are making their stand in Iraq, and we're going to get rid of them all there. But that's not what Porter Goss, the head of the CIA, said. He said they are training there, getting tremendous training in urban terrorism and urban warfare, and that they are successfully exporting these same people to other places. And if you take a look, there is, for example, the beginning of terrorist attacks in Kuwait that weren't there before. So it seems that the president continues with this tunnel vision. He's locked into this idea that the whole thing was about Iraq. It was never right in the first place. It's not right now. And our troops are being asked to do something that doesn't make sense in terms of fighting the overall war against terrorism. That's why we need a vision of how to finish the mission, and we need a timeline that would be flexible to allow us to imagine what kind of scenario would allow us to finish this.
Our guest is Wisconsin Senator Russell Feingold. Senator, isn't the president to some extent playing for time here? Wasn't that really what last night's speech was about, that the longer he plays for time, the longer he asks for patience from the American people, that maybe they'll get a constitution in place in the month of August, maybe they'll actually have elections, maybe he can still turn this thing?
Well, I mean, hopefully that's the motive. I have a feeling it's because the public opinion polls in this country, including in very conservative areas and in military areas where there's a lot of military, are going into the tank. And, you know, how many times are they going to point to something, whether it be mission accomplished on the ship, or whether it be the transfer of sovereignty, the capture of Saddam Hussein, the elections earlier this year? Each time they go, okay, if we can just get this, everything's going to turn around. Now they're talking about the Constitution. But that flies in the face of this insurgency. I was there in February, and they were saying, well, look, Russ, it's not that bad. We only have 50 or 60 attacks a day. Well, now they have 70 to 80 attacks a day. We have far more Americans being killed than we thought would be killed at this time. This insurgency is obviously in a very strong position, and I think, as you indicated, we're helping making it stronger. So I don't understand this rationale.
Senator, the president made much of the fact that there are now 160,000-odd Iraqi security forces. You were in Iraq in February. What is your best information about how many of them are actually trained enough to fight on their own without the assistance of American troops?
Well, that's exactly the point. I was there with Senator McCain, Senator Clinton, and others, and we asked General Petraeus, right in the green zone there, about these numbers. And he gave us the numbers. Actually, the numbers we got there were smaller than the numbers the president cites. And Senator McCain noted that the numbers were lower that we were getting there than in Washington from Rumsfeld. But in addition, there were real questions about how prepared these folks are. The president even indicated that many of these people are, some of these people are more ready to do what they have to do than others. So this is an inflated figure in my view. We're a long way away from having the training of the military and the police that would be necessary. And that's why I think the president should give us a time frame. When he thinks, when would it be possible, when can we imagine that this kind of expertise could be developed so that we can imagine that the Iraqis could stop the insurgency themselves and that we could imagine bringing home the men and women who have already given so much.
He'd probably answer you by saying when the nation is entirely bankrupt.
Well, that's how it seems. I mean, I have frankly, I've never seen a situation that is more loaded with cliches and phony arguments. This is one of the most disturbing moments in our recent history, and the president, I think, is almost completely failing.
Yeah, he plays Senator Feingold, he pays a lot of lip service to progress being made. Now, you were there in February, and for some reason, when they say this about schools and infrastructures, and after I've heard the stories about, you know, billions of dollars being lost, money being tossed around in duffel bags, and numbers like, you know, $2.5 billion here and there. And I get the feeling from everybody we've talked to that if there is progress, it must be a five-block radius tucked away in the green zone as a model neighborhood. I don't know. What do you know about that?
It's hard to know how anyone would know. I asked the people right there in the green zone, both military people and our State Department people. You know, we've got $20 billion set aside here, $20 billion, more than the entire foreign aid budget for the rest of the world for reconstruction. They said, given the security, how do you get out there and check? Well, it's pretty tough, they said. We've put unmanned vehicles out to take pictures to see if maybe they built a wall.
Oh,
this isn't good.
Oh, no.
Senator, one of the things the president did was to ask Americans to fly the flag on the 4th of July next Monday to try and help military families. Does he get any traction when he tries to tug at America's emotional heartstrings that way?
I think it's fine that he asked people to do that. I think it's a good thing. The troops need to know that despite the disagreements we have in the policy, that as Americans we understand that what they are sacrificing, what they are doing is way beyond what anyone could imagine to have asked. So I think it's great that there'll be that support. If it gives the president some kind of boost, fine. It won't last as a political ploy any more than anything else has. The reality is the deaths are going up of Americans. The reality is the insurgency is very strong. The reality is that we don't have a plan to finish this job and to get our troops out of there. And that's his problem. And he has done, in my view, absolutely nothing to solve his problem.
And you're going to help solve it by introducing your resolution tomorrow to the Senate. Is that true?
I introduced it a couple weeks ago.
Oh, 2 weeks.
And,
okay.
We're going to try to figure out some way on one of the appropriations bills, one of the upcoming bills, to offer that or something like it as an amendment. And it's very modest. It just says, look, Mr. President, would you please give us a plan within 30 days? And we could have required it. We could try to set the date ourselves, which I don't think is really what Congress generally should be doing. We could try to cut off the money, which I obviously have voted against. But how about just as a first step, asking the president to do his job?
That sounds good to us.
Vision of what's going on here.
That sounds good to us. Senator Russ Feingold of Wisconsin, really appreciate you being with us again. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Senator.
You take care. I love talking to that guy.
Yeah.
Build a wall.
This is incredible.
Yeah. It's 16 past the hour. You're listening to Morning Sedition with Mark and Mark on Air America Radio. When we come back, I'm sure we're going to talk more about Bush's speech, and we're going to talk more about the situation in Iraq, but we've also got other stuff, you know, on the menu. We've got, we're going to talk about racism fairly specifically in just a few minutes. So stay with us. It's 17 past the hour.
Join the morning sedition. Right now, call 866-303-2270.
What?
That's 866-303-2270.
You don't know until you've tried this.
Morning sedition on Air America Radio.
Damn good.
On the 90-day trial guarantee. Call 1-877-289-9200. That's 1-877-289-9200.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
It's morning sedition on Air America Radio. Of course, we've been talking about the faux Christian AWOL ex-blow monkey puppet of the Cheney regime's neocon death cult, George W. Bush's speech last night at Fort Bragg, justifying his faulty policy of generating terrorism and simultaneously fighting it for a war that could go on forever in the name of war profiteering and exploiting a global tone of fear in order to maintain power. That's the way we're looking at it here. In light of that, exactly. In light of that, exactly. In light of him not being honest about the fact that we are generating terrorists on a daily basis. Can we hear that, Chris?
The progress in the past year has been significant, and we have a clear path forward. To complete the mission, we will continue to hunt down the terrorists and insurgents. To complete the mission, we will prevent Al-Qaeda and other foreign terrorists from turning Iraq into what Afghanistan was under the Taliban, a safe haven from which they could launch attacks on America and our friends.
No, instead they're going to create an environment where Iraq is like Afghanistan, under the Russians, where they're going to create a new generation of terrorists. Perhaps George Bush has not read the December 2004 report from the CIA's National Intelligence Council, stating, quote, the Al-Qaeda membership that was distinguished by having trained in Afghanistan will gradually dissipate, to be replaced in part by the dispersion of the experienced survivors of the conflict in Iraq. Iraq and other possible conflicts in the future could provide recruitment, training grounds, technical skills, and language proficiency for a new class of terrorists who are professionalized and for whom political violence becomes an end in itself. So what George Bush is saying is that he is guaranteeing eternal warfare. So if you're a soldier and you didn't understand that, I sympathize because we have a president that is being disingenuous. That exactly what they want to create, the neocons, is a global culture of perpetual war.
You know, when you talk about the soldiers, Mark, he did say, fly a flag on the 4th of July, help military families. And that's all well and good. But why in the world could his administration have not helped military families? He knows there's a recruitment problem. Why doesn't he get the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Army and the Navy and Air Force secretaries together and develop some financial incentives for these people? Why not develop a recruitment bonus? Why not develop a retention bonus? Why not do some things to sweeten the pot so people will in fact believe that their service is valued somehow?
Mm-hmm. In a few minutes, we're going to be talking to Gary Young. He's from the Guardian newspaper of London, who recently traveled to Philadelphia, Mississippi, to get a sense of the state of race relations in the South. And, in leading up to talking to Gary Young, I want to talk about a story. This is in reference to a report released by the Journal Social Psychiatry and Psychiatric Epidemiology. The author, a guy named John Zeber, who studies quality, cost, and access issues for the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs. So the study was done on veterans, claims that although schizophrenia affects all ethnic groups at the same rate, blacks in the United States were more than four times as likely to be diagnosed with schizophrenia as whites, and Hispanics were more than three times as likely to be diagnosed as whites as well. And the study basically gets into the fact that differences in wealth and drug addiction and many other variables did not explain the disparity, and the culprit was indeed race. So this confirms that minorities are more likely to be misdiagnosed as having serious psychological problems than whites.
Yeah, and there are a number of reasons for this, and part of it, and see, what's happening now, Mark, mm-hmm. is that people are going back and re-diagnosing these people, taking a second look, and in many cases, what they thought was schizophrenia turned out to be depression over some very real issues. In one case that was mentioned here, they talked about a guy who was, uncommunicative, et cetera, was diagnosed as schizophrenic and delusional because he kept talking about somebody having killed his son in a hate crime. You know what turned out? His son was killed in a hate crime.
Well, I think it seems that a lot of the problems occur when you have people with cultural differences, like a clinician and a patient, who are doing the interviews, okay?
Yeah.
And either there's a translation problem or there's literally a cultural problem. When you have, a community, like in some parts of the black community, where they have rightful paranoia, rightful fears of how they're being treated culturally, and that's misdiagnosed as paranoid symptoms,
yeah.
then, they're not being sensitive to cultural issues. And this is a real sort of it's a strange point in the hardline psychiatric community, which sees this as political correctness intruding on the science of psychiatry, which is really how it should be looked at, is the cultural evolution of psychology, honoring the diversity of the American public.
Well, yeah, and see, the other thing, Mark, is that if people sense that they're being either misdiagnosed or not being paid the proper respect, you know what happens? They don't go back.
Yeah,
they don't go back to that psychiatrist. They end up dropping out of a lot of these studies.
Yeah, this is a very provocative piece here. And we're going to be talking to Gary Young about Mississippi specifically, and maybe about institutional racism on a broader level coming up next. So stay with us. It's 27 past the hour. You're listening to Morning Sedition with Mark and Mark on Air America Radio.
So tell me what you do.
You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Be born, because more babies means more $39,000 chickens to pay down the debt.
The Majority Report on Air America Radio.
Thirty-four past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. All morning we've been talking about George W. Bush and the neocons, death cults leader there, of sort of justifying the policy of generating terrorism and fighting at the same time for till the end of time. We will be talking about that a little more in a little while. And we're going to switch gears. There's more to racism in the South than the murders of Cheney, Goodman, and Schwerner. In fact, according to our next guest, the conviction and sentencing of Edgar Ray Killen last week hardly begins to address the issue. Gary Young is the New York correspondent for the London Guardian. His piece, Racism Rebooted, appears in the July 11th edition of The Nation. He's also the author of a book, No Place Like Home, A Black Britain's Journey Through the Deep South. He joins us live in the studio this morning. Good morning, Gary. How are you?
Good morning, Mark.
Good morning.
I'm glad you're here. So how close does the conviction in the senator and sentencing of Killen come to really? I mean, I read the piece in The Nation. It just seems like it doesn't. It only scratches the surface in even addressing the South's racism problem.
Yeah, I mean, it's symbolic,
mm-hmm.
and symbols are important, but you should never mistake them for substance. And the real substantial issue, not just in the South, but I think the whole of America, is institutional racism that keeps black people unemployed and the first to get fired, the last to get hired, the first to be arrested, the longest to be sentenced, and so on and so forth. And that what you have in these trials is a very convenient four guys, in a way. Not that, I'm glad that Killen was convicted. He should have been convicted. He probably should have been convicted for more than he actually was. But you arrest an 80-year-old white man, you don't really solve the problem of racism and bigotry in the South or in America. It's very convenient to dump that on an old white
guy. So it's a temporary relief in the sense of it seems like justice is being served at least in one case, and you get sort of a relief from that, but it doesn't really address the core issues, which are racism that infiltrates all of the culture.
That's right. The editor of the local paper, the Neshoba Democrat, who I'm pretty sure was a Republican, but in any sense, whatever he was, he said to me, he's a white guy, he said, there is equal opportunity here in Philadelphia, Mississippi. There is equal opportunity in Mississippi. If you want to do something, then you can do it. said to him, well, then how do you explain that African Americans are more likely to end up in jail, or at least likely to end up in employment, and earn half as much as white people, unless you just think they're lazy and stupid?
Mm-hmm. Kevin, you travel through the Deep South, and as someone who grew up in Britain, were there things that you expected to encounter that you did not, and were there things that you did not expect to encounter that you did? You go down there figuring, you know, I'm going to be down there with a group of white racists.
I figured that the casual racism would be greater than it was.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I've only had one serious racial incident in the South. That happened in Philadelphia a few weeks ago when I stopped to ask directions at the house of three old white people who are sitting out on the porch. They're the only people out. I asked the directions, and their response was, we've got a gun, we're going to shoot you. And so I asked again.
We've got a gun, we're going to shoot you.
So I asked again, and they came up with the gun thing again, and then the guy went back into his house to get his gun, at which point, you know, I've made my excuses.
You figure you go to the other side of the track to ask directions, huh?
And that's mind-blowing. It almost seems like, you know, he's honoring every stereotype that anyone assumes would be.
I know. It was almost as if I'd stopped and said, I'm looking for a stereotype. Old Southern racist, could you help me out here? So in that sense, but otherwise, you know, it's actually a kind of very, very kind of straightforward experience going to the South, partly because I'm not looking for a house. I'm not looking to put my kids in a school. I'm not trying to marry anyone who doesn't look like me. I'm just driving through in a rail car and staying in motels. If you're doing that, you're not going to get a Klansman come bash you on the head.
Now, there are some people, and I know that the South has projected this over time because I've seen it in my own experience. There are people who will say that black people who live in places like Philadelphia, Mississippi, have some kind of bond with whites that transcends race. And sometimes you will get black people in Mississippi who will look at you as an outsider the same way whites do. Did you experience that at all?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, in the same way that for all of the racial differences in America in general, you're all Americans, right? You come to Britain, and the first thing I think,
Yes!
And in the same, you know, they eat the same food. I mean, they listen to similar music, not the same music.
Not David Banner, I guess.
No, not quite David Banner. But in many, many ways, the whole myth of segregation was odious because white people were raised by black people. They were breastfed by black women. They slept with black people. Quite often, they lived in their houses because most slave owners did not own a huge amount of land. And so it was really always about white supremacy. It wasn't about, you could be as close as you liked so long as you knew your place. And they used to say that the difference between the North and the South is in the South, it doesn't matter how close you get, just how big. And in the North, it doesn't matter how big you get, just how close.
All right. Well, it's interesting in your piece that you say that there's actually a cottage industry based in racism in Mississippi, in Philadelphia, Mississippi, based specifically around the case of the three civil white workers killed in 64.
Yeah, there is an intense, and this has been going on for 20-something years, mm-hmm. an intense effort in the South to rebrand the South as a place that conquered its history. And I was reading today about this Iraq story and Dawn Bartlett saying, look, the past is the past, and we just, you know. And that's kind of, that is where an awful lot of the South would like to go. Look, let's just travel light, free from any baggage of history, and let's just put all that stuff behind us. You can vote now, shut up.
Yeah.
But one of the problems, I think, in engaging with any kind of conversation about the South is that you have to also take into account the North.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, the North, there's a very smug feeling that people in the North have about the South. That, you know, Southerners are crazy and we're not. If you're looking for the most segregated cities in America, they're all in the North. Milwaukee, Chicago, Newark, Philadelphia. The further south you get, St. Louis is the top 10 segregated cities.
I used to live in Boston. I still, to this day, don't know where the black people are there.
Right. But they're somewhere.
Yeah, they've hidden them somewhere.
Right. Gary Young, you've spent this time in the South. How would you recommend that people there, regardless of race, get rid of the stain of racism that has really hung over that region like a cloud for so many years?
I would say two things, and the first would be to have an honest appraisal of your history, to understand You know, there were some funny moments in that trial where, say, the prosecutor said to Killen's brother, do you know that your brother was in the Klan? He said, no, but the way I think of it, or the way I've heard it, your daddy and your granddaddy was in the Klan. And that was probably true. I mean, this entire town colluded in this murder. So there's no point in just stopping at this one person. So an honest appraisal of the history. And the second thing, I'm always frustrated in Britain at how rarely British people will honestly acknowledge race. It's like sex, politics, and religion. You just don't mention it in polite company. Mm-hmm. I'm always frustrated here at how rarely people discuss class. And I think that one of the roots out of it, there are a lot of poor white people in the South too. And until they understand that, or until they make common cause with a whole lot of poor black people and realize that actually poverty is their central issue, their lack of housing, their lack of health care. You take any indicator of health or wages or whatever, Mississippi's near the bottom, and then just halve it and you get the rate for black people. So you have an intensely a group of intensely poor people where black people are even poorer. And without some discussion of class, I can't see how they kind of beat their way out.
It's not even part of the cultural language here.
No.
The word class doesn't even exist in terms of differentiating, really. There's a lip service paid to middle class.
Yeah, but then you think middle between what and what?
Because
nobody ends up to be working class, and very few people end up to being rich either.
Mm-hmm.
Do the classes, white and black, do white and black middle class in the South, and particularly in terms of your experience, did you find that they mixed a lot? Were they comfortable with each other in public facilities, that sort of thing?
No. Almost at work they do, because they have to. But that otherwise, no, the African-American middle class has its own space. The white middle class has its own space. And there are good reasons for this. You know, not good as in favorable, but it's only been 50 years since, I mean, we forget how recently.
Yeah.
Only 40 years ago, African-Americans could vote.
That's,
you know, they didn't have a guaranteed right to vote. And so this is kind of one of those, like, in our lifetime kind of things. And so I did a lot of work in South Africa during the first elections and went back quite
94,
a lot.
Sure.
Yeah. And, you know, if you go to South Africa in the year 2034, it's not all going to be right. You know, there's still going to be a lot of work to do. It took several centuries to make it that bad. It's going to take a long time to make it better. The problem is when you see things kind of, or you feel that things are going in entirely the wrong direction, that they're not making things better, they're actually making things worse and entrenching the problem.
Did you feel that in Philadelphia?
Well, what I felt was that this trial could be one of those, or understanding of this trial could go one of two ways. Either we're going to wash our hands now, we've dealt with that. We've dealt with everything that was bad about Philadelphia. Let's move on and forget it. Or it could be, let's look at how that trial, what that trial meant to. You know, Killen once said, you know, that he was working to preserve the Mississippi way of life. Well, that way of life is still there. You know, Cheney, Goodman and Schwerner's work still hasn't been completed.
Sure.
And until that's done, then any understanding that you can now bury those people and the ideas that went with them is a step backwards, I think.
Our guest is Gary Young. I want to thank you for joining us. The book is No Place Like Home, A Black Britain's Journey Through the Deep South. And you can also see his most recent article called, Racism Rebooted at www.thenation.com. It's really a pleasure talking to you. Thanks for coming down today. What do we got? The war. What is it?
War on brains.
That's coming up next, and more on the horrendous display by Bush last night. It's 45 past the hour. You're listening to Morning's Edition with Mark and Mark. It's Air America Radio.
Hi, this is Rob Corddry from The Daily Show, here to remind you that when top news reporters and investigative journalists like me want their news skewed so far to the left it's wearing a dress, we turn to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Evaluate for 30 days. Call now 1-800-900-2657. That's 1-800-900-2657.
Fifty past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Yo!
The show is Morning Sedition. The network is Air America Radio. We'll be talking more about the Bush speech in just a few minutes. We got Robert Klein come in a little later.
Yeah.
To comedically bloviate about the Bush speech and other things, I'm assuming. But right now, every week we bring you the latest news from the front lines of the four-year global war being waged by the Bush administration. And here with today's dispatch from the War on Brains is war correspondent Mark Milfington.
Dateline, the Pentagon, the world's largest office structure, yet so efficiently built, it only takes 7 minutes to move between any two points in the building, especially when you're running from a plane.
Oh,
the war on brains continues, you unrepentant, echo-booming, sofa-assed heroes of the Burger Wars. For while you were busy creaming over Avril Lavigne's latest pseudo-punk foray into fake King angst, the neo-con desk militia at Fort Bumble began a relentless march into the from their family circus-covered cubicles deep into your bedrooms, where they're now rifling through your Blockbuster receipts and sniffing your yoga mat. Last week, the Department of Defense, or DOD, announced the inevitable, that it was ready to collect personal and confidential information on 16 to 18-year-olds for a new Army recruitment database designed to help America do two things. One, kill more insurgents. And two, kill more college-age students.
Oh, man.
The database will include students' birth dates, social security numbers, ethnicities, grade point averages, fields of study, email addresses, and every sad thing Mark Maron ever wrote in the John Stewart chat room under the pseudonym Candy Girl.
Wait a minute.
Shameful.
Do I need to?
Ignominious.
All right.
Mark.
What?
The information in these files will enable the government to ruthlessly study and select our children for sleazy exploitation faster than a micro camera hidden in one of Michael Jackson's llamas. Soon, heartless recruiters will be roaming our neighborhoods like salesmen, searching for victims, and armed with so much sensitive personal information, it'll make the Scientologists look like Amway.
Recruiters? Door-to-door recruiters?
That's right, Mark. Ever meet a fellow by the name of Rumsfeld?
What's the fella's line?
Never worries about his line.
Never worries about his line?
Or a doggone thing. He's just a bang-beat, bell-ringing, big hall, great-go, necker-nothing, rip-roaring every time a bullseye salesman. That's Secretary Rumsfeld. He's an Army man.
He's a what? He's a what?
And he sells war to the kids in town with the big brass bombs and the rat-a-tat guns and the piccolo with uniform suit with the shiny gold braid on the coat with a big red stripe running down.
But he doesn't know the territory.
Or doggone thing. Is this a bang, beat, bell, ringing, big hall, great go, neck or nothing, rip roaring every time a bullseye salesman. That's Secretary Rumsfeld. He's an Army man.
He doesn't know the territory.
You can bicker, bicker, bicker. You can talk. Bicker. You can talk all you want.
All right. Mort, I'm through with this now.
Look, what do you talk? You can talk.
Mark, shut up already.
Mark, Romney's failed attempt at running a war doesn't give him the right to decimate the next generation of bad poets and philosophy majors any more than your failed career in musical theater gives you the right to yell at me for being a sensitive artist. Remember that the next time Marky Jr. comes back from a home ec class and tells you hate his freedom. And that's today's dispatch from
the War on Brains.
Yeah. That was very good.
Yeah, did yourself today.
Shipoopy. The girl was hard to get.
I was worried at the beginning because you're starting to get tangled up, and I thought, we're never going to get through this. But,
well, you know how it is.
You pulled it up.
It's like 3 in the morning, isn't it? I haven't slept.
Something like, you haven't slept? What were you up doing?
Writing this crap. Searching all over the internet for the Music Man. What do you think I'm doing?
Did the burger fumes get to you? Are you okay?
Yeah, that pink patty has a face on it still.
Kayla was eating a breakfast cheeseburger, and apparently it's very raw inside. But, you know, it's nice, and there's nothing to worry about, according to the USDA spokesman.
This didn't come from the twitching cow.
No, I would hope not. It tastes good. It doesn't taste mad cowy, does it?
No.
Tastes great.
It does. Champion.
Yeah. But, and what do you got? What are you eating there with it, Kalo?
Some fries with ketchup.
That's good. That's good at 7 in the morning.
It's delicious.
It's almost like, what, are your parents out of town?
They are. I mean,
who eats a hamburger? It's like one of those things like, you know what? I'm going to do whatever I want. I'm having cake. No dinner.
This is, should digest in about 10 years. So don't worry about that.
Oh, good.
Wait, so now, you, that's right, we do the vegetarian thing with you, man. So what do you eat for breakfast as a vegetarian guy? I mean, do you eat a lot of cheese?
Yeah.
Do you find that it backs you up a little bit? I'm just curious.
Yeah, that's where the psyllium husk comes in.
Oh, so you eat cheese and psyllium husks. So you actually have to count.
Psyllium husks? That's right.
You know what that is, right?
And psyllium.
I know what psilocybin is.
No. It's a completely different effect. Right?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah,
wrong pee.
Wrong decade, Captain Triff.
Hey. Watch your mouth, all right?
The colors. Psyllium husks. No, this could be pretty much one color with the husks.
Gray?
No, I would hope not. Psyllium husks is a laxative, Mark. It's a naturally occurring laxative from the husks of psyllium. It's what the Metamucil is made out of, I believe.
Cliff bars.
Really?
Cliff bars.
Does that have psyllium husk in it?
Oh, I use it to clear myself out and clean the sink.
How about an AutoZone? We got an AutoZone?
Get into the zone! AutoZone!
Right. Nice work. Can I see your driver's license and registration?
Oh, Jim.
California.
You're doing great work here. Yeah. You know, you really are. And we really appreciate you coming down.
Yeah, see you in court.
Yeah. Wait, that's the other guy.
Sorry.
It's all right. AutoZone!
What the hell was that?
I'm sorry, man. I was trying to...
You know, just stay in your own area.
Remember your place.
All right, well, you can get out of it now. Could you get out of my area? Yeah. So you got things to do.
Time for now.
All right. It's been a hard day.
Bye!
Yeah, maybe you can churn out 2 jokes by the end of the day, so that'd be all right for tomorrow. Thanks, buddy. I'll talk to you later. Coming up, we got the comedian Robert Klein, and we're also we're going to talk more about the speech that the president, I guess, is what you call him.
Was that who he was?
He's posing as the president.
Oh my God! All coming up next on Air.
It's 6 past the hour. It's Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley. That's us.
Yeah.
Isn't that weird when you talk about yourself in the third person? It felt weird doing it. I don't even know where it came from.
That's right.
You got to mix it up sometimes, Riley.
That's right. Riley says so.
You're listening to Air America Radio. Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians, lurking conservatives. How are you? Look, we've been talking all morning about the faux Christian ex-blow monkey, AWOL puppet of the Cheney regime's neocon death cult's presentation to the country. Of course, George W. Bush, within 55 seconds and in two sentences into his speech proper, brings up the semantic engine of 9/11, and he just kicked it right into gear. Kalo, do you know how many times he said 9/11?
No, how many?
I don't know. Play the thing.
Okay.
The war reached our shores on September the 11th, 2001. The only way our enemies can succeed is if we forget the lessons of September the 11th. After September the 11th, I made a commitment to the American people. After September the 11th, 2001, I told the American people that the road ahead would be difficult. They are trying to shake our will in Iraq. Just as they tried to shake our will on September the 11th, 2001.
So what's that, 4 times?
That's 5 times.
Five times.
How many references to an exit strategy? Zero. How do you like that? How many references to freedom? 21. How many references to Saddam Hussein? 2. And then, you know, the weird thing is to me, Riley, is that they, and the media says this too, that they, you know, 9/11, he's using the 9/11 card. This isn't a card. This is the death of 3,000 Americans in a heinous attack on this country that's being exploited to further the faulty policy of a president whose poll numbers are dropping. He's exploiting the pain of the people. He's exploiting the fear of the people to try and bolster his numbers. And he's trying to exploit it in the name of a policy that I believe he secretly supports.
Well, you know, it's funny. Dan Pashman talks about how you rescue a stale bagel. You throw a little water on it, throw it in the microwave. That's what George W. Bush did with that speech last night.
Yeah.
He resuscitated a stale bagel.
This policy, though, the weird thing about this, the whole presentation he made, is that more than 2 years ago, Bush argued that Saddam Hussein's control over Iraq could make the nation a haven for terrorists. It wasn't then. Now, because of this administration's choices, it is not only a haven for terrorists, but a training ground for terrorists, and there really is no way to deny that. You know, looking at a lot of information that we have coming out of Iraq, that what's gone on in Iraq is that people, there are terrorists, foreign jihadists coming in from around the planet, not unlike they did when the Arabs, or when, you know, the Afghani Arabs that created Osama bin Laden were at the behest of us fighting fighting Russians in Afghanistan. These particular jihadists are fighting us, and we are saying that, you know, we will continue this fight as long as there is terrorism, yet our presence is generating terrorism. So it is a recipe for eternal war, which is what I think secretly this administration wants. They want to have an ideology and a series of policies in place that will funnel money into the military contracting business for the rest of time.
Well, you know, more than half of the more than 1,740 U.S. Troops that have died in Iraq have died over the past year. And, of course, that has been since George W. Bush declared mission accomplished. So we're looking at something here, Mark, that is inherently, I believe, dangerous for the future of the country if we're just going to continue to have this sort of open-ended war without end and rationales for it that are little more than pep rally.
Well, let's hear some of that rationale, Chris, can we?
The progress in the past year has been significant, and we have a clear path forward. To complete the mission, we will continue to hunt down the terrorists and insurgents. To complete the mission, we will prevent al-Qaeda and other foreign terrorists from turning Iraq into what Afghanistan was under the Taliban, a safe haven from which they could launch attacks on America and our friends.
Yeah, what they're doing is they're turning it into what Afghanistan was under the Russians, a training ground for terrorism. I guess our president didn't read a December 2004 report by the CIA's National Intelligence Council, which I will quote here. Quote, the al-Qaeda membership that was distinguished by having trained in Afghanistan will gradually dissipate to be replaced in part by the dispersion of the experienced survivors of the conflict in Iraq. Iraq and other possible conflicts in the future could provide recruitment, training grounds, technical skills, and language proficiency for a new class of terrorists who are professionalized and for whom political violence becomes an end in itself. So you see what they've got in place here is they've got a conflict against an enemy that regenerates itself as the conflict goes on. And when Bush read that list of where all those different places where terrorism has happened in the last year, it became clear to me, and it's been documented, that the acts of terrorism have risen since the Iraqi conflict began, and that his plan is essentially to guarantee that there is terrorism, and because he, as he's claiming now, Riley, as we've talked about before, he's saying this is a totalitarian ideology. It's not. It's a renegade version of Islam, and by calling it a totalitarian ideology, what he's doing is he's trying to posit this new terrorism or sort of capture it intellectually as being similar to the Cold War. He's putting in place an enemy that people like him and having the same ideology as him will last, they hope that it'll last a long time.
Well, remember too, Mark, that Bush went back to the Revolutionary War and talked about the Revolution and the Civil War and the wars during the 20th century because he wants to try and put Iraq in a particular context where Americans have fought what most Americans believe are just wars, Civil War, World War I, World War II. People didn't argue about whether or not America should have been there, not by and large. And Bush tried, I think failed, but tried nonetheless, to link Iraq to those struggles of the past.
Well, that's interesting because, like, he did it by repeating himself. This is a very interesting thing to me, is that the whole idea of propaganda, like what they tried to do with linking 9/11 to Iraq, that was repeated over and over again,
yep.
And that proved to be completely untrue. There wasn't terrorism in Iraq until now, until we went in there. And that's not calling us the terrorists, but it is calling us the helping to generate and train terrorists. Now, he did make a lot of similar statements, almost identical statements, to the speech he gave at the Army War College, when they turned over Iraq to Iraqis 2 days prior to them, when they were supposed to, because they were panicking at that time as well, that their polls were starting to droop. Now, let's hear that. Can we hear? This is Bush about making progress in Iraq at the Army War College last year.
We're making progress. Yet there still is much work to do.
And this is from last night at Fort Bragg.
We've made progress, but we have a lot more work to do.
We just talked to Senator Russ Feingold of Wisconsin, about that progress, and I'm assuming when they say they're making progress, you and I both know, Riley, that billions of dollars went into Iraq in duffel bags that was thrown into vans of contractors. There's $8-some-odd billion missing, and they keep talking about this progress in the name of their schools and roads and infrastructures, and I'm thinking they must be talking about some sort of strange, almost like real estate, when they have gated communities, they show the model house. They must have this Iraqi model neighborhood tucked away in the green zone somewhere, just so for when the press come or when dignitaries come to say, see, here's the progress, there's the one school, and there's the new house, and look at the street, and look, the faucet works.
Yeah, look, they got water. It's incredible.
But then here, let's talk about troop levels that he talked about. This is a year ago at the Army War College.
General Abizaid and other commanders in Iraq are constantly assessing the level of troops they need to fulfill the mission. If they need more troops, I will send them.
Now, let's hear what he said last night at Fort Bragg.
Some Americans ask me if completing the mission is so important, why don't you send more troops? If our commanders on the ground say we need more troops, I will send them.
Yeah, we know what happens when a commander requests more troops. They become former commanders.
Yeah, they get pushed out of the jobs that they're in. This was apparently, to all objective eyes, I would hope, a Bush administration in production that goes back 10 years, Mark. We're talking now, when we look at the neocons and the people that put this together, the Wolfowitzes, the Pearls, this is something that is 10 years old. They projected this idea of using Iraq specifically to achieve a bulkhead in the Middle East that would then end up transforming the entire region and to some extent guaranteeing the safety of Israel.
Yeah, and also guaranteeing perpetual war for perpetual peace.
Yes.
Is that how that works, right?
Well, yeah.
So, look, we got Robert Klein coming up. We're going to talk about some other things that are in the news. If you don't mind, we hope you're having a good Wednesday morning. So, please, stay with us, will you? It's 16 past the hour. It's Morning's Edition with Mark and Mark on Air America Radio.
Morning's Edition.
It's just to wake up.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
I've heard about those people.
On Air America Radio.
Thanks.
And so call us right now. 800-430-9571. 800-430-9571.
Twenty past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
Air America Radio's Morning's Edition. Happy morning, Wednesday, people. How's that go? Huh? Look, Kalo the iPod ho. I've just changed it. Kalo the iPod ho, because you haven't gone to Costco in a while, because I haven't seen my popcorn, please.
Yes.
That's right. Okay. It's better off. I don't need so much popcorn. But you say that you found out that we're ranked number 54 on iTunes in terms of podcasting?
Yes. iTunes just unveiled their iTunes 4.9, and that enables you to podcast. And I did a search for Morning Sedition. And I found out that we were ranked number 54.
So if you didn't know that you could do this, you can do this if you have an iPod. I will get an iPod if Apple sends me one, and I'm doing them justice right now. I'm going to talk to our marketing people. Send me one, the middle one preferably, so I don't have to worry about it too much. I don't want to be like Dan Pashman and feel like I have to completely download every CD in its entirety just to archive my collection like some sort of strange anal freak. But what's there a problem, Pashman? You got a problem? No, it's important that he has everything he has. Yeah, whatever. Well, I would like to have an iPod, and Dan Pashman is not an anal freak. He's just a fan of music. Okay,
sure.
Yes, but okay. I would like to say that you can podcast, and this helps a lot of people because in some areas we have been pushed off by local morning shows at the behest of Clear Channel affiliates who think that they can make more money that way, even though we've created a pretty good fan base in that area. For instance, like San Francisco, podcast there. You can podcast.
Yeah.
Some places we're cut off for an hour. You can podcast. We get a lot of emails from people podcasting. I guess what I'm saying is, please do it. Get us up to about number 10 on the
Number one
yeah. on the iTunes podcasting thing, and then more people will know about us, and that would be nice for us.
Yeah.
And Mark?
What?
You have a future Mark on line one.
Oh, I love Future Mark. Put him through. Hey, buddy,
what's up?
So, Future Mark, what's going on in 2050? Got any big plans for the 4th of July this weekend?
Oh, man, I am up to my ass in parades. There's one now.
Cool. Right outside your window?
Not cool. It's not like it used to be. What, you used to have like a couple of parades you'd go to a year? Now they're scheduled daily, and you're required to attend, sometimes two, three, and they're all over the place.
I don't understand.
Freaking Chinese New Year parade. All right, see? Here's what happened. After the mad potato outbreak of 2020, everybody kind of freaked out.
Mad potato?
Yeah. Think mad cow times 100, man. One French fry, and you're a babbling idiot. And it was contagious, too. So for about 3 years, everyone just kind of shut themselves indoors with their clones and cocooned. Everybody avoided each other like the plague.
Wait, so how's the parade thing fit in?
Hold on, let this one pass. Okay, well, the government decided to deny basic services unless you interacted with other people. They developed this thing called earned human contact points, and they monitor the crap out of it.
Wait, so you got to go to a parade for human contact points?
Yeah, or else. All kinds of parades. And you have to be in them and act like you give a crap. If it's one of the 300 Mardi Gras parades, you better wear a mask and throw beads. If it's a gay parade, you better squeeze into some go-go shorts and start dancing. It's nonstop, dude. Today I'm wearing my lederhosen for the June Oktoberfest parade. Oh, crap. I just missed it, didn't I?
No.
Well, I'll just change into my construction worker outfit.
Oh, union parade?
No, another gay parade. I'm on the village people float.
Wow.
Oh, man. I'm going to get in trouble talking with you. I'm missing all the required parades, dude.
Wait, so nobody enjoys this, man?
No, not really. People are pretty much post-emotional now.
Really?
You know how in 2005 you were starting to think, hey, everything's already been done?
Yeah.
Well, by 2050, everything has been done.
Wow.
There was this huge emotional void, and almost everyone was morbidly depressed.
Uh-huh.
And they figured maybe if we keep people constantly distracted, they won't notice.
Wow, what parade is that?
The 1980s parade.
God, will that decade ever die, man?
All right, I gotta go. I'm in the 2 o'clock Hayes Wednesday parade, and if I don't hit that, I'll just have to do the 3 o'clock. Missing the German parade kind of screwed me.
Hey, dude, wait, before I go, is there anything you want to, warn me about?
Yeah, War of the Worlds comes out Friday, right?
Yeah.
Go and take notes.
Mm-hmm.
You're gonna need them. That's all I'm saying. Huh. Well, that's my parade. Later, man.
All right, later, buddy.
Oh, man.
It's going to be stuck in our head for hours. I'm sitting here, like, talking to me, feeling guilty for saying that about Pashman. Pashman, I love you, man. You understand that?
Oh, come on.
You understand, buddy? What's the matter, Caleb? Can a guy have a moment with a guy without you feeling neglected?
No,
huh?
The fat guys. Yeah, see, can't you just say something bad about the person and just leave it at that? Why do you have to apologize like a little baby? Like a girl? Oh, I'm sorry. Oh.
Yeah,
Pashman, are you okay? Pashman, are we okay, Pashman?
I'm sorry for being a nice guy. You're right, Chris. You're right.
Get bigger.
Hey, how things at home, Chris? This wouldn't be you manifesting some of your weird BS, out a little anger.
Hey, I'm having problems with my girlfriend, sure.
Okay,
you know?
All right. So what, have we got to all pay for it? Here I'm being nice to a fella in the booth that works hard. What?
You're mad at him 1 minute, like, oh, I'm sorry, Pat. You're not even mad. You just say something about him, and now you got to take it back?
What? Look,
be a man.
Look,
be a man.
Is that what a man does? Is that a man doesn't apologize? Is that the kind of man that you look up to? Is that what you're saying? Dan Pashman said one of the most genius things to me about the way I am, and it was months ago. It was almost a year ago. He said, you know what, Maron? What was it?
You're
exactly.
Nuts.
I remember. He says, you don't hate yourself. You just, what was it? You want people to...
That sounds great.
Oh, yeah. What was that again?
He basically said, because, you know, I tend to think that I hate myself, and I don't. He says I don't hate myself. He says I just want people to take care of me. I think is what he said.
Uh-oh.
It blew my mind at the time because it was very revealing to me because, in a sense, that is true. I don't hate myself, and I just like you to be nice to me, Chris. Is that so hard? All right? Is that so hard? I think you owe me an apology.
Yeah, we're not going to get it, my friend.
Why didn't you just apologize?
When I say something, I mean it, all right?
Oh, really?
That's right.
I'll remember that, man. I'm going to make note of that. Robert Klein's coming up here.
Yeah, that's going to be fun.
Yeah, he's got a new book out, and I'm sure he'll have plenty to say about politics, because Robert Klein talks, my friend.
Next on Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning's Edition on Air America Radio.
How righteous we are. We have to show those liberal hippies.
Jerry Springer on Air America Radio.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Yo!
This morning's edition on Air America Radio. I remember what Bashman said to me. He said, you don't hate yourself. You just want people to make you feel better. That's it. And he is an anal freak. I retract my apology because he came in on the break and said, you know what? After you said that, I told Brendan, yeah, I am an anal freak. So that's that. Our guest has made more than 100 appearances on The Tonight Show and The Late Show with David Letterman. He was nominated for a Tony Award for his performance in Neil Simon's They're Playing Our Song. He's co-starred in numerous films. And he's the author of a new book, The Amorous Busboy of Decatur Avenue. Mr. Robert Klein is here with us. Good morning, sir.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
So how are you feeling? You feeling good?
I am feeling good. I'm promoting my book, proving that I'm literate. There are no pop-ups or scratch and sniffs in it.
You wrote the whole thing by yourself?
You better believe it.
Good for you.
5 years. Took me too long, but...
So besides the book, I mean, how are you feeling about this administration? Did you watch that speech last night?
What is this, some sort of political
show?
Sure,
why not? I know you got some juice on it.
No, I got the crib notes on it. Okay. I did not watch the speech.
In general, how do you feel about Bush?
I read the thing. Well, how do I feel about him?
Sure.
He's best personified when he was debating Kerry, when he was foaming from the mouth.
Uh-huh.
That's what I feel about. I'm very much against Bush. In fact, I long for his father, who looks so much better by comparison.
Right.
it was, a nasty campaign in which... Once again, our candidate was cornered. You know, I was part of two of the most successful presidential campaigns of the 20th century, Mondale and Dukakis. I made all the decisions. I said, Mike, go to this army base. Put on the tank helmet. It's a good look. The earlaps will look good with the Mediterranean honker and the bushy eyebrows.
Oh, wow.
Perfect.
No. See, my theory is that I wrote an article in the Times a number of years ago on how show business and politics have melded.
Sure.
You know, have become one. And my theory is it's all image. I remember subtly when Mike Dukakis was nominated and these Mississippi pals on CNN go, well, you know, they were ethnicizing his name, making sure you know it's a very strange name. Well, as far as I'm concerned, you know, Mike Dukakis is a perfectly good American. You know, it's up to you if you want President Dukakis or you want President Bush. Of course, Bush is a Pavlovian signal for 14 million alcoholics to get up and get a beer. I haven't had an ice cold Dukakis in memory. But I always thought it was like image. For example, Howard Dean, when you lose control, we're going to get him in Iowa, we're going to get him in... You know, they carried him off with phenobarb in his tuchus.
Yeah, and they kept repeating it over and over.
And you
and
know
over.
It. When they grabbed, just like the tank helmet, when they saw Dukakis with that helmet looking like Alfred E. Newman, they went, schmuck alert, schmuck alert. And what's his name, Roger Ailes and all these Republican geniuses took pictures. I remember, Quayle was probably, by American standards, like the white movie star, handsomest guy. The guy was very good looking, remember?
Yeah, totally empty upstairs.
No, he had good looks.
Couldn't spell potato, the guy.
Couldn't spell potato. And his father owned Indiana, had to make a few calls for him after college. Well, he does like journalism. No, he doesn't want to deliver the papers. He wants to be, I own the paper. Does that help? You know? So he debated Lloyd Benson.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Benson was an elegant, I believe, self-made millionaire Texan. And that's when Quayle brought up JFK. Remember,
yeah.
He said, I knew JFK. You're no JFK.
Sure.
But the thing is that he really lost that debate image-wise because his dentures were didn't fit. Here's Benson talking, and there's that funny look. You know, I was adjusting the set. When I first saw Greta Van Susteren, I kept on adjusting it.
And, oh, my God.
Well, she's not so bad looking. It's just that something's out of kilter there. Something. It was like when I bought my first color set, they said, you tune the color to the human face. So I bring home this Sylvania, and there's a Met game on, and Cleon Jones is batting with a close-up. So I adjust it to his face, and the field turned blue.
I got a question.
Anyway,
you're
talking to Robert Klein is here.
So let me just say, Benson, I just want to make this point. Yeah. Benson, you know, why he buys his teeth at the Home Depot is beyond me. The guy's got millions.
You get a bunch of them.
Well, finally, it became, the disparity became, so he's saying one thing, his teeth are saying another. People don't trust politicians as it is. Get together with your damn teeth. And people were discussing it. I thought the teeth were more truthful. Oh, ridiculous. I thought he was more, those teeth were lying through their teeth. Those teeth were truthful. Couldn't you tell that those teeth... And then finally, Bush Sr. himself is a great American life. He never really made an impression in any of his job. Shot down in World War II.
Yeah.
There's footage of it from a submarine. Yeah. Congressman, head of CIA, ambassador to China, vice president, right? He lost by image when he committed a diplomatic and political no-no. Namely, he puked on the Japanese premier.
Publicly.
And, oh, my God, he's dead. I didn't vote for him. I felt so bad. And then I said, well, we have laws of succession. We don't fight in the streets. My God, I felt so terrible. I go, okay, well, who's going to be president? Quail! Quail! Will he come and they won't go home? You know the rest. Quail! Quail! Oh, Bushy puked on the Japanese premier. Will he come and they won't go? Next time he wear their rubber underwear. Will he come and they won't go?
Nice. I got a question for you about your book.
No comment.
No comment.
Oh, sorry.
Everybody I talk to who lived in the Bronx in the late 50s, early 60s, missed over when they talk about that. I mean, their eyes glaze over. Yeah. It was a very special place and a very special time. Why? What was it?
Well, I thought it was boring when I was living there, though, to be honest with you. It's only through the gauze of time. It makes everything pretty. Doris Day, towards the end of a career, when the bumps on her face and the wrinkles, they put gauze on the legs.
Fear of the end makes you cling to the past.
Her final film, you can't see her at all. The gauze was so thick that you just hear her voice. But you know what? From a distance, it was a wonderful, idyllic in certain instances, existence. A butcher shop, a grocery store, the pharmacy, actually two of each, three of each.
Mm-hmm.
Walmarts,
You knew everybody. You knew the people on the street.
And you were loyal to them. We had our movie theater. I never took a school bus in my life. I went PS 94, junior high school 80, Dewey Clinton High School, walked the whole time.
Oh, wow.
But the thing is that the 50s, going from the sexual mores of the 50s to the 60s, which is what a lot of the book is about, it was like going from the 19th century to the 20th.
I bet.
You know what I mean?
Sure.
Like, you know, the girls were good girls, and they wanted to neck as much as you wanted them to, but they, you know.
So it was actually a week where everyone just went bad?
Well, it's only a few years. The sexual revolution,
sure.
My God, I mean, which was so much more fun than the Bolshevik or French Revolution.
Right.
And a lot less dangerous. No AIDS.
Yeah.
You remember the good old uncomplicated days of syphilis?
Sure.
And gonorrhea?
Yeah.
I had the cramps. I mean, I had the crabs ones, but that's more zoological than pathological.
You can name them.
No, my book is about, it's about, there's a lot of sex in it, but it's not salacious sex. It's actually told sweetly and hilariously, I think, but it's about when things were new. When sex was new, when my first baseball glove got from Hijinks Sporting Goods on Jerome Avenue.
Well, did you had sex with your baseball glove?
Huh?
No, just I'm just trying to figure out we got from one to the other so quickly.
Well, I almost did.
We're all blended together
when
in
you're
the
young.
Gauze.
Yeah.
I loved it that much, the myth.
It's a good myth. And that's how you break them in, I heard, in the Bronx.
You know, I mean, when I first owned books, when I went to Alfred University, I mean, New York City Board of Education gave me my textbooks, and any books I read for pleasure, I went to the library. I never owned a book till I was 16 years old. I went to college, you know.
We're talking to Robert Klein. The book is The Amorous Busboy of Decatur Avenue. It's amazing to me that, and then after the 60s, do you go into the beginning of your comedy career? Because a lot of people don't realize that you had some of the biggest selling comedy albums ever.
Yeah, I mean, I it's not a big show business biography at all. It ends when I'm 25.
Oh, okay.
Uh-oh. And the only show business stuff is some really, I think, interesting portraits of the friends that I made at the early improv days. The improvisation was the only club that's got in America. And I first went there in the fall of 66, where I met, a year later, Bette Midler. We became very good friends. Richard Pryor. Danny Aiello was the bouncer, and of course Rodney Dangerfield, who was my Yale Drama School for comedy. I mean,
yeah.
And this he comes off glowingly in my book here. In the early Rodney, the later Rodney became a mixed bag. I mean, he's a sad case.
Well, it's interesting that
he could never get happy. You know,
right. And it seemed to me like, you know, because I saw him towards not the end of his career, but when he did that, they did the roast to him. In Aspen, it really struck me that he was really alienated from a lot of guys, like from your generation, from all the guys. It just seemed like he didn't have a lot of old friends.
Well, at his funeral, which is small there, but Jim Carrey and Leno and all, what a great guy and all. But it was always about him. And, at the beginning, he opened the club to protect his children so he wouldn't have to go on the road because his wife was incapable of taking care of his kids. She was mentally ill. She was an alcoholic. He was married and divorced twice to her. And she was living with a nurse. And one day he calls me. He said, I'll tell you about it. You know, Joyce died. So I said, he wasn't married to her anymore. Yeah. I said, are the kids okay? Yeah. He says, I'll tell you about it. I'd appreciate it if you wouldn't say anything. I got a lot of good wife jokes. I thought, Jesus, this is a man devoted to his, there's an account in the book of David Fry, who was a great impressionist.
Yeah.
He used to do LBJ and Nixon. He was incredible, a little rat. He was a kind of nasty, misanthropic little guy. And
a rat.
The night Bobby Kennedy was killed, he was in the back and he was drinking a lot. And he was kind of tears in his eyes. I put my arm, we were all down, you know, I put my arm around him. He says, I'll tell you, man, you know, I'm sorry he's dead, but it was one of my best voices. These are the tales of sentimental dudes.
I want to hear some more stuff. I want to hear some more stories from the old improv, because they opened a new improv, and I got to tell you, you know all the pictures that Silver Friedman, the owner of the club, Button Silver, had on the wall? They've got, like, copies of the actual cutout. It's weird. They at the new one, and they just sit in the hallway, and I swear to God, most people couldn't even tell you who those people are, like Lenny Schultz, the people. Well, let's talk about that a little more with Robert Klein.
Well, people not knowing Lenny Schultz is not the worst.
Lenny Schultz
did not deserve to be known.
All right, we'll talk about that.
He made noises and one spit on the first table.
We're talking to Robert Klein. It's 46 past the hour. You're listening to Air America Radio's Morning Sedition, and we're going to continue talking to Robert Klein after this.
Morning Sedition, delivering you from evil. In 3 hours or less, Air America Radio.
If you want past the hour, we're going to land this thing. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey.
Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. With us here in the studio, comedy legend Robert Klein.
Hey.
There he is.
I'll get my hat. Well, since you hate, I'll hate too.
We're going to continue the conversation, but first let's break some news here, Riley. It looks like they've decided upon the new Freedom Tower.
Yeah, they made a public display. Of course, the police had criticized, and there was a big controversy here in New York about exactly when the police said that there was a problem, a security concern with the placement of the tower initially. Apparently, they fixed all of that. This is going to go up 69 stories from fortified base. It will go to an observation deck at 1,362 feet and a glass parapet at that same height, which would equal the height of the Twin Towers. I mean, look.
Here's a conversation I'll be had in front of that building. Like, I'm not comfortable going up. You go ahead and go up.
Yeah. And I'm not locating there. I'll locate in Midtown over here on the far west side where they were going to build a stadium.
Uh-huh.
Well, I mean, there was something peculiarly fiendish about, their plan. A 767 full of fuel prepared to go to the West Coast. But had the building been constructed in a different way, and it probably wouldn't have had a catastrophic collapse, and I think they had that in mind. It's unlikely that such a large plane that could happen again, but someone might try something.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I think you got to do the Jerusalem method. You know, they blow up a pizza parlor and it's mm-hmm. open for business 4 days later. I think you've got to just do it.
It's going to take a little longer than 4 days.
There's a lot of tall buildings in the country.
No, I think you're right. I think that they should have a tall building there. Absolutely.
You know what I mean? Right. And it's something unique for the skyline and all that. It's just, Mark, we were talking. I mean, neither of us liked the original towers, but now I suddenly feel proprietary
about
them. You know,
I wish they had built down there, and I don't think they ever will, but it would have been nice if they had built some kind of affordable housing and reserved it for cops and firemen. Why not?
Yeah, that was.
I mean, they were the heroes of September 11th. Why not build some housing down
there?
That's
a good idea.
They can't afford to live in Battery Park.
Because they want to live in Nassau County and Staten Island. That's why.
We're talking to Robert Klein.
They don't want to live there.
His new book, The Amorous Busboy at Decatur Avenue.
Decatur.
The Amorous Busboy of Decatur Avenue.
I have a problem when I read as opposed to just say. And I just read and I had decadence on my mind. We were talking about the old improv before we went away to break,
right.
And you say you go up through some of that in the book, and I'm fascinated with that place because I started at the Improv when it was in its last throes. It was almost
you mean the
gone.
Original one.
The original one on 44th Street.
That's
and,
right.
And one thing, what I was talking about with the pictures before is a lot of people don't realize, and of course you do because of your history in comedy, is that there are so many unsung heroes and people that have come through the Improv and come through comedy that no one knows about.
Well,
and the Improv was full of them.
Yes, it was. In those old days, even the audience was kind of on the fringes of show business before the civilians found out. That's why I was able to write so much material. A lot of the audience was the same every night. But that's where, and I looked at the same faces. I wanted to make them laugh. So Danny Aiello was the bouncer. Uh-huh. No one knew how talented he was. I said, bouncer? He was enormously talented because they didn't like fights. They didn't like disorderly conduct. And if someone insisted, while some tenor is up there singing Fiddler on the Roof.
Well, they did that then. It wasn't just just comedy,
well,
right?
His fist would move no more than 2 or 3 inches.
Yeah.
Into a stomach, like an inflating of air, and they'd be dragged out like Harpo at the end of a scene in the Marx Brothers. Pryor was, who's the best I ever saw live,
mm-hmm.
He was collegiate then. This was before his makeover.
Still doing Cosby,
authentic,
kind of, right?
It was, in my opinion, funnier.
Yeah.
He was adorable on Merv Griffin. He wore white sweaters like anyone for tennis, and he was adorable. He was incredibly appealing and funny. And then we were hanging out together. He was, he noticed we got our material similarly, and at one point I asked him what college he went to, and he went, yeah! And I fell off the chair. Went to the College of Pimps and Whores in Peoria.
Yeah.
And he smacked a girl in front of the club once, and I had to go over this with him and say, do you do this often? And the next day he apologized and all that. But the one that was that really affected me the most, and I sort of followed him around to gigs for a few years, was Rodney, you know.
Sure.
And he had a gig in Cape Cod, because I'd learned technique. He wasn't well-known yet. I certainly wasn't well-known. We're up in Cape Cod. There are 40-knot winds on the bay, right? Uh-huh. He's in a place there. He goes, I'll tell you, man, let's take out a sailboat. I go, sailboat? What do you? I'll tell you, it's too much. Let's take out a sailboat. What do you know about sailing? He said, what's there to know? It's the wind. It's not. So he gives $20 to the boat boy, Vinny.
Yeah. And Vinny goes, Rodney, you know, it's 40-knot winds out there. You sure you want to go out? You know,
I notice no one else is sailing in the capital of sailing, you know, that knows how to sail. So he gives him a quick lesson. This is the forecastle. This is the mainsail. This is number one. Just give me the keys. I know what to do. And about 10 seconds, we're 900 yards from shore. You could have water skied behind this catamaran. I'm terrified. It's like two Jews on a sailboat. To be saga that never should have happened. And in the middle, he goes, I'll tell you, man, I'm going to take a swim. I go, Rodney. Rodney becomes a speck. I don't know how to change the forecastle or the mainsail because I'm from the Bronxel. So I push the rudder all the way to one side. And make a nice tight turn of 6 miles.
We gotta go, Robert. We gotta go.
Saved his life.
Oh, you saved his life. Good. The amorous busboy of Decatur Avenue, Robert Klein's new book. Thank you for listening here on the Morning Edition. What do we got tomorrow? We got John Butler Trio.
Oh, yeah.
That's gonna be good. We got Jessica Cutler, also known as the Washingtonine, whatever.
Whatever it is. Washingtonette.
That's something like that.
Have a good one. It's Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition.